and there is something inside me, some selfish beast of a subtle thing that doesn't like the truth at all because it carries responsibility, and if I actually believe these things, I have to do something about them. It is so, so cumbersome to believe anything. And it isn't cool. I mean, it's cool in a Reality Bites, Welcome to Sarajevo, Amnesty International sense, but that is only as good as dreadlocks. Chicks dig it to a point, but you can't be all about it. You also have to want a big house and expensive clothes, because in the end, our beliefs are about as enduring as seasonal fashion. In the end, we like Ethan Hawke, even though we don't know what he believes. Even our beliefs have become trend statements. We don't even believe things because we believe them anymore. We only believe things because they are cool things to believe. The problem with Christian belief, I mean real Christian belief, the belief that there is a God and a devil and a heaven and a hell, is that it is not a fashionable thing to believe. I had this idea once that if I could make Christianity cool, I could change the world. Because if Christianity were cool, then everybody would want to deal with their sin nature. And if everybody dealt with their sin nature, then most of the world's problems would be solved. I decided that the best way to make Christianity cool was to use art. I attempted to write a short story about a fashionable Christian so that everybody would want to be like him. My fashionable Christian was deep. Deep water. A poet. He studied Thompson during his drug years, during the prostitute years. He had studied The Hound of Heaven, In No Strange Land, T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. He smoked a pipe and read the Romantics. And the Americans. Ginsberg's I Watched the Greatest Minds of My Generation Descend into Madness was, to him, about sin nature. Part of him was about social justice. He could also skateboard and was in a rock band. His name was Tom Toppins, and even though he had a goofy name, he overcame it because he rode an old Triumph motorcycle. In my story, Tom Toppins was casually dating a girl with blonde dreadlocks. She was a Buddhist. He was a Christian. He attended a Greek Orthodox church. She would go with him to church every once in a while, but he would not participate in her faith. He thought it was shallow, too much about fashion. He told her this over lunch at her loft apartment, and she exploded in anger. Then she cried, but he did not comfort her. He stood up and put on his jacket and lit up a cigarette and told her he was going to church. She screamed out, "How can you Christians maintain such an exclusive hold on truth?" He straightened his jacket while looking in a mirror and whispered to himself, "'Cause that's the way it is, baby. That's the way it is." He walked out the door and left her weeping in agony, rubbing the belly of her little statue of Buddha. He didn't think of her again till the next day when he went by her apartment. Tom Toppins walked in and, though it was afternoon, found her sleeping, her face all red and wet with tears. He pulled a book of poems from his motorcycle jacket, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and read to her from Sonnets from the Portuguese until she gently woke up. He lay down next to her and set her head on his free arm. She buried her head in his armpit and sobbed, but he didn't stop reading. "My own beloved, who has lifted me from this drear flat of earth where I was thrown, and in betwixt the languid ringlets blown a life-breath till the forehead hopefully shines out again, as all the angels see before thy saving kiss. My own, who camest to me when the world was gone, and I who looked for only God found thee." I saw a movie the other day about all these people at this college back east, and it was a pretty grimy movie. There was a character in the movie, this guy who was a drug dealer and a jerk, and everybody else in the movie loved him and wanted to have sex with him. One of my housemates, Grant, was saying to me the other day that girls always like bad guys. My friend Amy is like that, I think. and so was my friend Susie, but Susie said she got over it, and now she likes guys who are relatively nice and stable. The thing about Tom Toppins, though, is that he really believed things. He wasn't swayed. The same thing that was in the drug dealer in that grimy movie that I absolutely do not recommend is the same thing that was in Tom Toppins. Belief. Drug dealer dude was not looking for somebody to pat him on the back and teach him things. He was moving, going, sure of something, even if it was all depravity, even if he was leading people into hell. If you believe something passionately, people will follow you. People hardly care what you believe as long as you believe something. If you are passionate about something, people will follow you because they think you know something they don't, some clue to the meaning of the universe. Passion is tricky, though, because it can point to nothing as easily as it points to something. If a rapper is passionately rapping about how great his rap is, his passion is pointing to nothing. He isn't helping anything. His beliefs are self-serving and shallow. If a rapper, however, is rapping about his community, about oppression and injustice, then he is passionate about a message, something outside himself. What people believe is important. What people believe is more important than how they look, what their skills are, or their degree of passion. Passion about nothing is like pouring gasoline in a car without wheels. It isn't going to lead anybody anywhere. My friend Andrew, the protester, believes things. Andrew goes to protests where he gets pepper sprayed, and he does it because he believes in being a voice of change. My Republican friends get frustrated when I paint Andrew as a hero, but I like Andrew because he actually believes things that cost him something. Even if I disagree with Andrew, I love that he is willing to sacrifice for what he believes. And I love that his beliefs are about social causes. Andrew says it is not enough to be politically active. He says legislation will never save the world. On Saturday mornings, Andrew feeds the homeless. He sets up a makeshift kitchen on a sidewalk and makes breakfast for people who live on the street. He serves coffee and sits with his homeless friends and talks and laughs, and if they want to pray, he will pray with them. He's a flaming liberal, really. The thing about it is, though, Andrew believes this is what Jesus wants him to do. Andrew does not believe in empty passion. All great Christian leaders are simple thinkers. Andrew doesn't cloak his altruism within a trickle-down economic theory that allows him to spend $50 on a round of golf to feed the economy and provide jobs for the poor. He actually believes that when Jesus says feed the poor, he means you should do this directly. Andrew is the one who taught me that what I believe is not what I say I believe. What I believe is what I do. I used to say that I believed it was important to tell people about Jesus, but I never did. Andrew very kindly explained that if I do not introduce people to Jesus, then I don't believe Jesus is an important person. It doesn't matter what I say. Andrew said I should not live like a politician, but like a Christian. Like I said, Andrew is a simple thinker. A friend of mine, a young pastor who recently started a church, talks to me from time to time about the new face of church in America, about the postmodern church. He says the new church will be different from the old one, that we will be relevant to culture and the human struggle. I don't think any church has ever been relevant to culture, to the human struggle, unless it believed in Jesus and the power of his gospel. If the supposed new church believes in trendy music and cool web pages, then it is not relevant to culture either. It is just another tool of Satan to get people to be passionate about nothing. Tony asked me one time if there was anything I would die for. I had to think about it for a long time, and even after thinking about it for a couple of days, I had a short list. In the end, there weren't very many principles I would die for. I would die for the gospel because I think it is the only revolutionary idea known to man. I would die for Penny, for Laura and Tony. I would die for Rick. Andrew would say that dying for something is easy because it is associated with glory. Living for something, Andrew would say, is the hard thing. Living for something extends beyond fashion, glory, or recognition. We live for what we believe, Andrew would say. If Andrew the protester is right, if I live what I believe, then I don't believe very many noble things. My life testifies that the first thing I believe is that I am the most important person in the world. My life testifies to this because I care more about my food and shelter and happiness than about anybody else. I am learning to believe better things. I am learning to believe that other people exist, that fashion is not truth. Rather, Jesus is the most important figure in history, and the gospel is the most powerful force in the universe. I am learning not to be passionate about empty things, but to cultivate passion for justice, grace, truth, and communicate the idea that Jesus likes people, and even loves them. Chapter 11. Confession. Coming out of the closet. When I was in Sunday school as a kid, my teacher put a big poster on the wall that was shaped in a circle like a target. She had us write names of people we knew who weren't Christians on little pieces of paper, and she pinned the names to the outer circle of the target. She said our goal by the end of the year was to move those names from the outer ring of the circle, which represented their distance from knowing Jesus, to the inner ring, which represented them having come into a relationship with Jesus. I thought the strategy was beautiful because it gave us a goal, a visual. I didn't know any people who weren't Christians, but I was a child with a fertile imagination, so I made up some names. Thad Thatcher was one, and William Wonka was another. My teacher didn't believe me, which I took as an insult, but nonetheless, the class was excited the very next week when both Thad and William had become Christians in a dramatic conversion experience that included the dismantling of a large satanic cult and underground drug ring. There was also levitation involved. Even though they didn't exist, Thad and William were the only people to become Christians all year. Nobody else I knew became a Christian for a very long time, mostly because I didn't tell anybody about Jesus, except when I was drunk at a party, and that was only because so many of my reservations were down, and even then nobody understood me because I was either crying or slurring my words. When I moved downtown to attend Imago Dei, the church Rick started, he was pretty serious about loving people regardless of whether they considered Jesus the Son of God or not, and Rick wanted to love them because they were either hungry, thirsty, or lonely. The human struggle bothered Rick, as if something was broken in the world and we were supposed to hold our palms against the wound. He didn't really see evangelism, or whatever you want to call it, as a target on a wall in which the goal is to get people to agree with us about the meaning of life. He saw evangelism as reaching a felt need. I thought this was beautiful and frightening. I thought it was beautiful because I had this same need. I mean, I really knew I needed Jesus like I need water or food, and yet it was frightening because Christianity is so stupid to so much of our culture, and I absolutely hate bothering people about this stuff. So much of me believes strongly in letting everybody live their own lives, and when I share my faith, I feel like a network marketing guy trying to build my downline. Some of my friends who aren't Christians think that Christians are insistent and demanding and intruding, but that isn't the case. Those folks are the squeaky wheel. Most Christians have enormous respect for the space and freedom of others. It is only that they have found a joy in Jesus they want to share. There is the tension. In a recent radio interview, I was sternly asked by the host, who did not consider himself a Christian, to defend Christianity. I told him that I couldn't do it, and moreover that I didn't want to defend the term. He asked me if I was a Christian, and I told him yes. Then why don't you want to defend Christianity? He asked, confused. I told him I no longer knew what the term meant. Of the hundreds of thousands of people listening to his show that day, some of them had terrible experiences with Christianity. They may have been yelled at by a teacher in a Christian school, abused by a minister, or browbeaten by a Christian parent. To them, the term Christianity meant something that no Christian I know would defend. By fortifying the term, I am only making them more and more angry. I won't do it. Stop 10 people on the street and ask them what they think of when they hear the word Christianity, and they will give you 10 different answers. How can I defend a term that means 10 different things to 10 different people? I told the radio show host that I would rather talk about Jesus and how I came to believe that Jesus exists and that he likes me. The host looked back at me with tears in his eyes. When we were done, he asked me if we could go get lunch together. He told me how much he didn't like Christianity, but how he had always wanted to believe Jesus was the Son of God. For me, the beginning of sharing my faith with people began by throwing out Christianity and embracing Christian spirituality, a non-political, mysterious system that can be experienced but not explained. Christianity, unlike Christian spirituality, was not a term that excited me, and I could not in good conscience tell a friend about a faith that didn't excite me. I couldn't share something I wasn't experiencing, and I wasn't experiencing Christianity. It didn't do anything for me at all. It felt like math, like a system of rights and wrongs and political beliefs, but it wasn't mysterious. It wasn't God reaching out of heaven to do wonderful things in my life. And if I would have shared Christianity with somebody, it would have felt mostly like I was trying to get somebody to agree with me rather than meet God. I could no longer share anything about Christianity, but I loved talking about Jesus and the spirituality that goes along with a relationship with him. Tony the Beat poet says the church is like a wounded animal these days. He says we used to have power and influence, but now we don't. And so many of our leaders are upset about this and acting like spoiled children, mad because they can't have their way. They disguise their actions to look as though they are standing on principle, but it isn't that, Tony says. It's bitterness. They want to take their ball and go home because they have to sit the bench. Tony and I agreed that what God wants us to do is sit the bench in humility and turn the other cheek like Gandhi, like Jesus. We decided that the correct place to share our faith was from a place of humility and love, not from a desire for power. Each year at Reed, they have a festival called Ren Fair. They shut down the campus so students can party. Security keeps the authorities away, and everybody gets pretty drunk and high, and some people get naked. Friday night is mostly about getting drunk, and Saturday night is about getting high. The school brings in Whitebird, a medical unit that specializes in treating bad drug trips. The students create special lounges with black lights and television screens to enhance kids' mushroom trips. Some of the Christian students in our little group decided this was a pretty good place to come out of the closet, letting everybody know there were a few Christians on campus. Tony the Beat poet and I were sitting around in my room one afternoon, talking about what to do, how to explain who we were to a group of students who, in the past, had expressed hostility toward Christians. Like our friends, we felt like Ren Fair was the time to do this. I said we should build a confession booth in the middle of campus and paint a sign on it that said, "Confess your sins." I said this because I knew a lot of people would be sinning, and Christian spirituality begins by confessing our sins and repenting. I also said it as a joke. But Tony thought it was brilliant. He sat there on my couch with his mind in the clouds, and he was scaring the crap out of me because for a second, then for a minute, I actually believed he wanted to do it. Tony, I said very gently. What? He said, with a blank stare at the opposite wall. We are not going to do this, I told him. He moved his gaze down the wall and directly into my eyes. A smile came across his face. Oh, we are, Don. We certainly are. We are going to build a confession booth. We met in Commons. Penny, Nadine, Mitch, Ivan, Tony, and I. Tony said I had an idea. They looked at me. I told them that Tony was lying and I didn't have an idea at all. They looked at Tony. Tony gave me a dirty look and told me to tell them the idea. I told them I had a stupid idea that we couldn't do without getting attacked. They leaned in. I told them that we should build a confession booth in the middle of campus and paint a sign on it that said, "Confess your sins." Penny put her hands over her mouth. Nadine smiled. Ivan laughed. Mitch started drawing the designs for the booth on a napkin. Tony nodded his head. I wet my pants. They may very well burn it down, Nadine said. I will build a trap door, Mitch said with his finger in the air. I like it, Don. Ivan patted me on the back. I don't want anything to do with it, Penny said. Neither do I told her. Okay, you guys. Tony gathered everybody's attention. Here's the catch. He leaned in a little and collected his thoughts. We are not actually going to accept confessions. We all looked at him in confusion. He continued, we are going to confess to them. We are going to confess that as followers of Jesus, we have not been very loving. We have been bitter, and for that we are sorry. We will apologize for the Crusades. We will apologize for televangelists. We will apologize for neglecting the poor and the lonely. We will ask them to forgive us, and we will tell them that in our selfishness, we have misrepresented Jesus on this campus. We will tell people who come into the booth that Jesus loves them. All of us sat there in silence because it was obvious that something beautiful and true had hit the table with a thud. We all thought it was a great idea, and we could see it in each other's eyes. It would feel so good to apologize for the Crusades, for Columbus and the genocide he committed in the Bahamas in the name of God, apologize for the missionaries who landed in Mexico and came up through the West, slaughtering Indians in the name of Christ. I wanted so desperately to say that none of this was Jesus, and I wanted so desperately to apologize for the many ways I had misrepresented the Lord. I could feel that I had betrayed the Lord by judging, by not being willing to love the people he had loved and only giving lip service to issues of human rights. For so much of my life, I had been defending Christianity because I thought to admit that we had done any wrong was to discredit the religious system as a whole. But it isn't a religious system. It is people following Christ. And the important thing to do, the right thing to do, was to apologize for getting in the way of Jesus. Later, I had a conversation with a very arrogant Reed professor in the parking lot in which he asked me what brought me to Reed. I told him I was auditing a class but was really there to interact with the few Christians who studied at Reed. The professor asked me if I was a Christian evangelist. I told him I didn't think I was, that I wouldn't consider myself an evangelist. He went on to compare my work to that of Captain Cook, who had attempted to bring Western values to indigenous people of Hawaii. He looked me in the eye and said the tribes had killed Cook. He did not wish me a greater fate at Reed. All the way home on my motorcycle, I fumed and imagined beating the professor into a pulp right there in the parking lot. I could see his sly smile, his intellectual pride. Sure. Christians had done terrible things to humanity, but I hadn't. I had never killed anybody at all. And those people weren't following Jesus when they committed those crimes against humanity. They were government people, and government always uses God to manipulate the masses into following them. Both Clinton and Bush claim to be followers of Jesus. Anybody who wants to get their way says that Jesus supports their view. But that isn't Jesus' fault. Tony had come to campus a few days earlier, a bit sad in the face. He had seen a bumper sticker on one of the cars in the parking lot that read, "Too bad we can't feed Christians to the lions anymore." I prayed about getting in the confession booth. I wondered whether I could apologize and mean it. I wondered whether I could humble myself to a culture that, to some degree, had wronged us. But I could see in Penny's face, in Ivan's eyes, that this was what they wanted. They wanted to love these people, their friends, and it didn't matter to them what it cost. They didn't care how much they had been hurt, and they certainly had more scars than either Tony or I. And so we bought the wood and stored it in my garage, and Friday night we went to the thesis parade and watched everybody get drunk and beat drums and dance in the spray of beer. Tony and I dressed like monks and smoked pipes and walked among the anarchy, becoming soaked in all the alcohol spewing from within the crowds. People would come up to us and ask what we were doing, and we told them that the next day we would be on campus to take confessions. They looked at us in amazement, sometimes asking us whether we were serious. We told them to come and see us, that we were going to build a confession booth. The next morning, while everybody was sleeping off their hangovers, Mitch, Tony, and I started building the thing. Mitch had the plans drawn out. The booth was huge, much bigger than I expected, almost like a shed, complete with a slanted roof and two small sections inside, one for the monk and the other for the confessor. We built a half-high wall between the two rooms and installed a curtain so the confessor could easily get in and out. On our side, we installed a door with a latch so nobody could come in and drag us away. Nadine painted "Confession Booth" in large letters on the outside of the booth. As the campus started to gather energy, people walking along the sidewalk would ask what we were doing. They stood there looking at the booth in wonder. "What are we supposed to do?" they would ask. "Confess your sins," we told them. "To who?" they would say. "To God," we would tell them. "There is no God," they would explain. Some of them told us this was the boldest thing they had ever seen. All of them were kind, which surprised us. I stood there outside the booth as a large blue mob started running across campus, all of them, more than 100 people, naked and painted with blue paint. They ran by the booth screaming and waving. I waved back. Naked people look funny when they are for real naked, outside a magazine naked. Saturday evening at Ren Fair is alive and fun. The sun goes down over campus, and shortly after dark, they shoot fireworks over the tennis courts. Students lay themselves out on a hill and laugh and point in bleary-eyed fascination. The highlight of the evening is a glow opera that packs the amphitheater with students and friends. The opera is designed to enhance mushroom trips. The actors wear all black and carry colorful puppets and cutouts that come alive in the black light. Everybody oohs and ahs. The party goes till nearly dawn, so though it was late, we started working the booth. We lit tiki torches and mounted them in the ground just outside the booth. Tony and Ivan were saying that I should go first, which I didn't want to do, but I played bold and got in the booth. I sat on a bucket and watched the ceiling and the smoke from my pipe gather in the dark corners like ghosts. I could hear the rave happening in the student center across campus. I was picturing all the cool dancers, the girls in white shirts moving through the black light, the guys with the turntables in the loft, the big screen with the swirling images and all that energy coming out of the speakers, pounding through everybody's bodies, getting everybody up and down, up and down. "Nobody is going to confess anything," I thought. "Who wants to stop dancing to confess their sins?" and I realized that this was a bad idea, that none of this was God's idea. Nobody was going to get angry, but nobody was going to care very much either. There is nothing relevant about Christian spirituality, I kept thinking. God, if he is even there, has no voice in this place. Everybody wants to have a conversation about truth, but there isn't any truth anymore. The only truth is what is cool, what is on television, what protest is going on what block, and it doesn't matter the issue. It only matters who is going to be there, and will there be a party later, and can any of us feel like we are relevant while we are at the party? And in the middle of it, we are like Mormons on bikes. I sat there wondering whether any of this was true, whether Christian spirituality was even true at all. You never question the truth of something until you have to explain it to a skeptic. I didn't feel like explaining it very much. I didn't feel like being in the booth or wearing that stupid monk outfit. I wanted to go to the rave. Everybody in there was cool, and we were just religious. I was going to tell Tony that I didn't want to do it when he opened the curtain and said we had our first customer.
What's up, man?
Duder sat himself on the chair with a smile on his face. He told me my pipe smelled good. Thanks, I said. I asked him his name, and he said his name was Jake. I shook his hand because I didn't know what to do, really.
So, what is this? I'm supposed to tell you all of the juicy gossip I did at Ren Faire, right? Jake said.
No.
Okay, then what? What's the game? He asked.
Not really a game. More of a confession thing.
You want me to confess my sins, right?
No, that's not what we're doing, really.
What's the deal, man? What's with the monk outfit?
Well, we are... well... a group of Christians here on campus, you know.
I see. Strange place for Christians, but I'm listening.
Thanks, I told him. He was being very patient and gracious.
Anyway, there's this group of us, just a few of us who were thinking about the way Christians have sort of wronged people over time. You know, the Crusades, all that stuff.
Well, I doubt you personally were involved in any of that, man.
No, I wasn't, I told him. But the thing is, we are followers of Jesus. We believe that he is God and all, and he represented certain ideas that we have sort of not done a good job at representing. He asked us to represent him well, but it can be very hard.
I see, Jake said. So, there's this group of us on campus who wanted to confess to you.
You are confessing to me, Jake said with a laugh.
Yeah, we are confessing to you. I mean, I am confessing to you.
You're serious?
His laugh turned to something of a straight face. I told him I was. He looked at me and told me I didn't have to. I told him I did. And I felt very strongly in that moment that I was supposed to tell Jake that I was sorry about everything.
What are you confessing? He asked.
I shook my head and looked at the ground.
Everything, I told him.
Explain, he said.
There's a lot. I'll keep it short, I started.
Jesus said to feed the poor and to heal the sick. I have never done very much about that. Jesus said to love those who persecute me. I tend to lash out, especially if I feel threatened, you know, if my ego gets threatened. Jesus did not mix his spirituality with politics. I grew up doing that. It got in the way of the central message of Christ. I know that was wrong, and I know that a lot of people will not listen to the words of Christ because people, like me, who know him, carry our own agendas into the conversation rather than just relaying the message Christ wanted to get across. There's a lot more, you know.
It's all right, man,
Jake said, very tenderly. His eyes were starting to water.
Well, I said, clearing my throat, I'm sorry for all of that.
I forgive you, Jake said.
And he meant it.
Thanks, I told him. He sat there and looked at the floor, then into the fire of a candle.
It's really cool what you guys are doing, he said. A lot of people need to hear this.
Have we hurt a lot of people? I asked him.
You haven't hurt me. I just think it isn't very popular to be a Christian, you know, especially at a place like this. I don't think too many people have been hurt. Most people just have a strong reaction to what they see on television. All these well-dressed preachers supporting the Republicans.
That's not the whole picture, I said. That's just television. I have friends who are giving their lives to feed the poor and defend the defenseless. They're doing it for Christ.
You really believe in Jesus, don't you? He asked me.
Yes, I think I do. Most often I do. I have doubts at times, but mostly I believe in him. It's like there's something in me that causes me to believe, and I can't explain it.
You said earlier that there was a central message of Christ. I don't really want to become a Christian, you know, but what is that message?
The message is that man sinned against God, and God gave the world over to man, and that if somebody wanted to be rescued out of that, if somebody, for instance, finds it all very empty, that Christ will rescue them if they want. That if they ask forgiveness for being a part of that rebellion, then God will forgive them.
What's the deal with the cross? Jake asked.
God says the wages of sin is death, I told him. And Jesus died so that none of us would have to. If we have faith in that, then we are Christians.
That is why people wear crosses? He asked.
I guess.
I think it's sort of fashionable. Some people believe that if they have a cross around their neck or tattooed on them or something, it has some sort of mystical power.
Do you believe that? Jake asked.
No, I answered. I told him that I thought mystical power came through faith in Jesus.
What do you believe about God? I asked him.
I don't know. I guess I didn't believe for a long time, you know. The science of it is so sketchy. I guess I believe in God, though. I believe somebody is responsible for all of this, this world we live in. It's all very confusing.
Jake, if you want to know God, you can. I'm just saying if you ever want to call on Jesus, he will be there.
Thanks, man. I believe that you mean that.
His eyes were watering again.
This is cool what you guys are doing, he repeated. I'm going to tell my friends about this.
I don't know whether to thank you for that or not, I laughed. I have to sit here and confess all my crap.
He looked at me very seriously.
It's worth it, he said. He shook my hand, and when he left the booth, there was somebody else ready to get in. It went like that for a couple of hours. I talked to about 30 people, and Tony took confessions on a picnic table outside the booth. Many people wanted to hug when we were done. All of the people who visited the booth were grateful and gracious. I was being changed through the process. I went in with doubts and came out believing so strongly in Jesus I was ready to die and be with him. I think that night was the beginning of change for a lot of us. Ivan started taking a group to a local homeless shelter to feed the poor, and he often had to turn students away because the van wouldn't hold more than 20 or so. We held an event called Poverty Day where we asked students to live on less than $3 a day to practice solidarity with the poor. More than 100 students participated. Penny spoke in Vallam Lounge on the topic of poverty in India, and more than 75 students came. Before any of this, our biggest event had about 10 people. We hosted an evening where we asked students to come and voice their hostility against Christians. We answered questions about what we believed and explained our love for people, for the hurting, and we apologized again for our own wrongs against humanity and asked for forgiveness from the Reed community. We enjoyed the new friendships we received, and at one time had 4 different Bible studies on campus specifically for people who did not consider themselves Christians. We watched a lot of students take a second look at Christ. But mostly, we as Christians felt right with the people around us. Mostly, we felt forgiven and grateful. Sometime around 2 or 3 in the morning, the night we took confessions, I was walking off the campus with my monk robe under my arm, and when I got to the large oak trees on the outskirts of the front lawn, I turned and looked at the campus. It all looked so smart and old, and I could see the lights coming out of the student center, and I could hear the music thumping. There were kids making out on the lawn and chasing each other down the sidewalks. There was laughing and dancing and throwing up. I felt very strongly that Jesus was relevant in this place. I felt very strongly that if he was not relevant here, then he was not relevant anywhere. I felt very peaceful in that place, and very sober. I felt very connected to God because I had confessed so much to so many people and had gotten so much off my chest, and I had been forgiven by the people I had wronged with my indifference and judgmentalism. I was going to sit there for a little while, but it was cold and the grass was damp. I went home and fell asleep on the couch, and the next morning made coffee and sat on the porch at Graceland and wondered whether the things that happened the night before had actually happened. I was out of the closet now. A Christian. So many years before I had made amends to God, but now I had made amends to the world. I was somebody who was willing to share my faith. It felt kind of cool, kind of different. It was very relieving. Chapter 12. Church. How I Go Without Getting Angry. It should be said, I am an independent person. I don't like institutionalized anything. I don't like corporations. I am not saying institutions and corporations are wrong or bad. I am only saying I don't like them. Some people don't like classical music. Some people don't like pizza. I don't like institutions. My dislike might stem from a number of things, from the non-personal feel I get when I walk into a corporate office, or the voicemail system I encounter when I call my bank. It might be the non-engaged look on every fast food worker's face, or the phone calls I receive in the middle of dinner asking me what long-distance carrier I use. Those people never want to just talk. They always have an agenda. My dislike for institutions is mostly a feeling, though, not something that can be explained. There are upsides to institutions, of course. Tradition, for example. The corridors at Harvard, rich with history, thick with thought. The availability of good, hot Starbucks coffee at roughly 30 locations within 5 miles of my home. And what about all those jobs? Without the corporate machine, where would people work? I suppose we need them. The institutions, the corporations. But mostly I don't like them. I don't have to like them either. It's my right. I don't like church either, for the same reason. Or I should say I didn't like church. I like attending a Catholic service every once in a while, but I think that is because it feels different to me. I grew up Baptist. I like watching religious television every once in a while. It's better than Comedy Central. I want to study psychology so I can sit in front of religious television and figure out these people's problems. For a while, I was very fascinated with televangelists. I couldn't afford a television ministry, but I had a computer, so I would go into Christian chat rooms and try to heal people. It was funny at first, but it got boring. Some of my friends have left their churches and gone Greek Orthodox. I think that sounds cool. Greek Orthodox. Unless you were Greek. Then it sounds like that is where you were supposed to go, as though you are a conformist. If I were Greek, I would never go to a Greek Orthodox church. If I were Greek, I would go to a Baptist church. Everybody there would think I was exotic and cool. I go to a church now that I love. I never thought I would say that about a church. I never thought I could love a church.
but I love this one. It is called Imago Dei, which means image of God in Latin. Latin is exotic and cool. In the churches I used to go to, I felt like I didn't fit in. I always felt like the adopted kid, as if there was room at the table for me. Do you know what I mean? I was accepted but not understood. There was room at the table for me, but I wasn't in the family. It doesn't do any good to bash churches, so I'm not making blanket statements against the church as a whole. I have only been involved in a few churches, but I had the same tension with each of them. That's the only reason I bring it up. Here are the things I didn't like about the churches I went to. First, I felt like people were trying to sell me Jesus. I was a salesman for a while, and we were taught that you were supposed to point out all the benefits of a product when you were selling it. That is how I felt about some of the preachers I heard speak. They were always pointing out the benefits of Christian faith. That rubbed me wrong. It's not that there aren't benefits, there are. But did they have to talk about spirituality like it's a vacuum cleaner? I never felt like Jesus was a product. I wanted him to be a person. Not only that, but they were always pointing out how great the specific church was. The bulletin read like a brochure for Amway. They were always saying how life-changing some conference was going to be. Life-changing? What does that mean? It sounded very suspicious. I wish they would just tell it to me straight rather than trying to sell me on everything. I felt like I got bombarded with commercials all week and then went to church and got even more. And yet another thing about the churches I went to, they seem to be parrots for the Republican Party. Do we have to toe the party line on every single issue? Are the Republicans that perfect? I just felt like in order to be a part of the family, I had to think George W. Bush was Jesus. And I didn't. I didn't think that Jesus really agreed with a lot of the policies of the Republican Party, or for that matter, the Democratic Party. I felt like Jesus was a religious figure, not a political figure. I heard my pastor say once, when there were only a few of us standing around, that he hated Bill Clinton. I can understand not liking Clinton's policies, but I want my spirituality to rid me of hate, not give me reason for it. I couldn't deal with that. That is one of the main reasons I walked away. I felt like by going to this particular church, I was a pawn for the Republicans. Meanwhile, the Republicans did not give a crap about the causes of Christ. Only one more thing that bugged me, then I will shut up about it. War metaphor. The churches I attended would embrace war metaphor. They would talk about how we are in a battle, and I agreed with them, only they wouldn't clarify that we were battling poverty and hate and injustice and pride and the powers of darkness. They left us thinking that our war was against liberals and homosexuals. Their teaching would have me believe I was the good person in the world, and the liberals were the bad people in the world. Jesus taught that we were all bad, and he is good, and he wants to rescue us because there is a war going on, and we are hostages in that war. The truth is we are supposed to love the hippies, the liberals, and even the Democrats, and that God wants us to think of them as more important than ourselves. Anything short of this is not true to the teachings of Jesus. So I was speaking at this 20-something ministry, speaking to about 50 or so people on Sunday nights at a church in the suburbs, all the while dying inside. I wasn't even attending the main worship service anymore. The pastor who was in charge of the college group asked me why I wasn't coming to church. He was very kind and sympathetic and said he missed seeing me there. Tony the Beat Poet says I am not good with diplomacy. He says I speak my mind too much and I should consider the ramifications of my words. I can be a real jerk without even realizing it.
I told the guy it was hard for me to go to church without getting angry, and I think he took that personally. I tried to explain how I felt, but I was speaking a different language. I felt stupid, too, like some bitter idiot, all wet and wanting everybody to cater to me, to my ideas about who Jesus is and was and the way he wants us to live. About that time, I started asking God to help me find a church where I would fit. I had this friend from Seattle named Mark who was the pastor of a pretty cool church near the University of Washington in the Village. He had a lot of artists going to his church and a lot of hippies and yuppies and people who listened to public radio. I went up and visited him one time, and I loved the community he had put together. I felt like I could breathe for the first time in years. Visiting Mark's church in Seattle helped me realize I wasn't alone in the world. I would talk to my friends about his church, to my friends at the church I was attending, but they didn't get it. Mark had written several articles for secular magazines and had been interviewed a few times on the radio and had gotten this reputation as a pastor who said cuss words. It is true that Mark said a lot of cuss words. I don't know why he did it. He didn't become a Christian till he was in college, so maybe he didn't know he wasn't supposed to say cuss words and be a pastor. I think some of my friends believed that it was the goal of the devil to get people to say cuss words, so they thought Mark was possessed or something, and they told me I should not really get into anything he was a part of, because of the cuss words. But like I said, I was dying inside, and even though Mark said cuss words, he was telling a lot of people about Jesus, and he was being socially active, and he seemed to love a lot of people the church was neglecting, like liberals and fruit nuts. About the time I was praying that God would help me find a church, I got a call from Mark, the cussing pastor, and he said he had a close friend who was moving to Portland to start a church and that I should join him. Rick and I got together over coffee, and I thought he was hilarious. He was big, a football player out of Chico State. At the time, we both chewed tobacco, so we had that in common. He could do a great Tony Soprano voice, sort of a mafia thing. He would do this routine where he pretended to be a mafia boss who was planting a church. He said a few cuss words, but not as bad as Mark. Rick said there were a few people meeting at his house to talk about what it might look like to start a church in Portland, and he invited me to come. I could feel that God was answering my prayer. So I went. There were only about 8 of us, mostly kids, mostly teens just out of high school. I felt like I was at a youth group, honestly. I didn't think the thing was going to fly. Rick's wife made us coffee, and we sat around his living room, and Rick read us some statistics about how very many churches have moved out of the cities and into the suburbs, and said how he wanted us to plant in the city. Rick really wanted to redeem the image of the church to people who had false conceptions about it. Pretty soon there were 20 or so of us, so we got this little chapel at a college near downtown and started having church. It felt funny at church, you know, because there were only 20 of us and it was mostly just kids. But I still believed this was how God was going to answer my prayer. We didn't grow much, to be honest. We stayed at about 30 or so, all Christians who had moved to Imago from other churches. I know that numbers shouldn't matter very much, but to be honest, I kind of wanted Imago to grow because I wanted my friends at my old church to know we were successful. But we didn't grow. We stayed at about 30. We'd meet on Sunday nights and then again on Wednesday nights for prayer. A lot less people showed up for prayer. There were only about 10 of us, and it was pretty boring. It felt like an AA meeting gone bad. We'd sit around and talk about the crap in our lives, and then we'd pray for a little while, and then we would go home. One night Rick showed up sort of beaten looking. He had been to some sort of pastor's reception where a guy spoke about how the church has lost touch with people who didn't know about Jesus. Rick said he was really convicted about this and asked us if we thought we needed to repent and start loving people who were very different from us. We all told him yes, we did, but I don't think any of us knew what that meant. Rick said he thought it meant we should live missional lives, that we should intentionally befriend people who were different from us. I didn't like the sound of that, to be honest. I didn't want to befriend somebody just to trick them into going to my church. Rick said that was not what he was talking about. He said he was talking about loving people just because they exist. Homeless people and gothic people and gays and fruit nuts. And then I liked the sound of it. I liked the idea of loving people just to love them, not to get them to come to church. If the subject of church came up, I could tell them about Imago, but until then, who cared? So we started praying every week that God would teach us to live missional lives, to notice people who needed to be loved. Lots of people started coming to church after that. I don't know why, honestly, except that we all agreed we would love people and be nice to them and listen and make friends. As we grew, we had to move into another building, and then another one after that, and then to another one, until we started renting this big, super old, beautiful church with stained glass windows and a domed ceiling. Shortly after we moved in there, we had to go to 2 services. All of this happened in a couple of years, and now Imago has about 500 people coming, and lots of them look like rock stars, but they are all brilliant and spiritual. I love the community so much it's hard to describe. I have never felt such a feeling of family in all my life. I felt like I had nothing in terms of community, and God brought a community up out of the ground, out of pure nothing, like a magic trick. Like I said before, I never thought I would love church. But here is what I love about Imago Dei. First, it is spiritual. What I mean is the people at Imago pray and fast about things. It took me a while to understand that the answer to problems was not marketing or program, but rather spirituality. If we needed to reach youth, we wouldn't do a pizza feed and a game night. We would get together and pray and fast and ask God what to do. God led some guys to start a homeless teen outreach downtown, and now they feed about 100 homeless teenagers every week. It is the nuttiest youth group you will ever see, but that is what God said to do. I love that sort of thing, because rather than the church serving itself, the church is serving the lost and lonely. It gives me chills when I think about it, because it is that beautiful of a thing. Second, art. Imago supports the arts. Rick isn't much of an artist, but he turned things over to a guy named Peter Jenkins, who created the drawings for this book. Peter started an artistery where artists live and create art, teach art, and encourage people to be creative. Peter recently held a gallery opening in a local coffee house, and all the art was created by people who attend Imago. Artists feel at home at Imago. I even led a short story group where we wrote short stories and then had a reading under Christmas lights and candles over at the artistery. I think there are artists at a lot of churches who don't have an outlet, and by creating an outlet, the church gives artists a chance to express themselves, and in return, the church gets free stuff to put on their walls. Creating an arts group at a church is a great idea. Third, community. Rick is very, very serious about people living together, eating together, and playing together. He encourages young single people to get houses and live with each other. Rick doesn't like it when people are lonely. We have home communities that meet all over town, and we consider this to be the heart of our church. Almost every church I have ever been to already does a great job at this. Fourth, authenticity. This is something of a buzzword, I know, but Imago actually lives this. I speak from the pulpit at Imago from time to time, and I am completely comfortable saying anything I like. I don't have to pretend to be godly in order for people to listen. authenticity is an enormous value at Imago. I love this because by being true, I am allowing people to get to know the real me, and it feels better to have people love the real me than the me I invented. So one of the things I had to do after God provided a church for me was to let go of any